Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. It's the 2nd of March, 2023. The time's 9:02 a.m., I guess, 9:01 a.m. With me today is Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, Senator Wilson, myself, Stedman. We have a quorum. The other senators are traveling on other state business. But today, we're going to talk about SNAP backlog, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, more commonly known as food stamps, and Medicaid redeterminations. So we've got some presenters here. We have the commissioner designee, Heidi Hedberg, if she can come forward, if she had. And then do you want to be joined by the other two, or do you want to, okay, she wants a lifeline right away. So we'll ask the deputy commissioner, Emily Rissy, to come forward. Probably mispronounce your name, but you can correct that for the record. And Josie Stern, assistant commissioner. So we'll go ahead and do the presentation today, walk through it. We'll probably have some questions, and I'd like you, in your presentation, to kind of give the committee a little background. Obviously, how we ended up in this position, and on notifications. Why this wasn't highlighted earlier, like in the previous budget process a year ago or what have you, so we can get in front of this, some of this, these issues. So with that, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and take us through your presentation, please.
For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, and with me I have Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner, and Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner. I'm going to advance to slide 2. So the Division of Public Assistance, the mission is to promote the self-sufficiency and provide for basic living expenses to Alaskans in need. The division has 458 permanent employees and 65 long-term non-permanent employees, and they oversee 18 different public assistance programs. The two primary largest public assistance programs is Medicaid with 262,000 Alaskans, and the SNAP program that has 92,000 Alaskans.
Oops. Maybe before you go on to slide number 2, on the recipients at 274, I think there was some different numbers used yesterday, wasn't there? Some that qualify and then some that are enrolled or something. There was a numeric difference. Maybe Senator Wilson could help me with that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the question is this the total number of recipients versus the total number of enrollees, people actually receiving services versus people actually qualified for Medicaid program?
For the record, through the Chair, Senator Wilson, my name is Emily Ritchie. I'm Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. And the number on the slide is specific to recipients across all programs. I would say specific to the Medicaid program, which I think is where this question was generated. There's about 263,000 beneficiaries, and about 72% of those are actually recipients, meaning they are actually utilizing the services. Okay. That might account for the differential in the numbers.
Okay, thank you. We'll go on to the next slide.
For the record, this is Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Health. This slide reflects the Division of Public Assistance's budget from the FY 2022 actuals, which is what the division spent in FY 2022, to the FY 2024 Governor amended budget, which was released on February 14th. Comparing the FY 2024 Governor amend to 2022 actuals,
slow down a little bit so folks could follow along, and we have time this morning.
Okay, sir.
And Senator Wilson will be queuing up the subcommittee, so we want to make sure he hears all these good numbers.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So the notable increases from FY 2022 to FY 2024 Governor amended are in the unrestricted general fund section, which is the blue section, and that increased by about $7.2 million. The federal, which is reflected in the yellow section, increased by $22.2 million. And these increment requests will be addressed at a later slide.
Do we have any questions on that? Next slide, please.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. And I'm going to speak to slide four, which is really focused on the SNAP backlog and the timing. So focusing on, and this is a three-year look back. So I want to underscore that the global pandemic and the cyber attack had significant impacts to the planned upgrades of the legacy IT systems. The pandemic, when it happened, when it rolled out in 2020, there were new federal relief programs that were disseminated to states, the emergency allotments and the pandemic EBT, electronic benefit transfer. And that was predominantly to support kids for their lunches. Our IT systems were so old that they were not able to absorb those new relief programs from our federal partners, which required manual processing, manual monthly processing by our eligibility technicians for over 2 years. In addition, the public health emergency that the Department of Health was leading really dominated a lot of the HR and procurement time through those emergency contracts, procuring supplies, getting vaccines, supporting the communities. That negatively impacted the other divisions within the Department of Health. And I think part of what we're seeing here is, and we'll talk about it in our further slides, there is a five milestone roadmap to addressing our IT legacy systems. Some of that work was not able to be accomplished because our procurement team and our HR staff were solely focused on the public health emergency that the state was grappling with, and again, and acknowledged that it impacted the Division of Public Assistance and they weren't able to do some of their contracts. In addition, in 2021, in May, there was a cyber attack. And at the time, we did not know as a department the total impact that it would have to our IT systems. At the time, our IT staff took those IT systems offline, and that caused a lot of our staff to revert to manual processes. As part of that, we also had to redirect those IT staff to focus on the forensics analysis because it's a high priority that we're protecting the personal health information of every Alaskan. I highlight both of those things, and then I want to take a step back and just say that this was built on historic levels of issues within the Division of Public Assistance and what they've been facing. The division's overtaxed and lack of integrated IT systems, the inefficient workflow processes, is not new, and that impacts the timely application processing. This administration and prior administrations have been dealing with this. I feel like I'm in a better position now because of the department reorganization. With a smaller department, I have a more narrow focused span of control, which is where when I started in November, I have spent the predominant most of my time focusing on the Division of Public Assistance. In addition, we have new leadership within the Division of Public Assistance. And I think that culmination is really going to support us because my goal is that we would have a functioning integrated IT system, that we would have more efficient workflow processes so that our staff have the benefit of these efficient systems and Alaskans have those timely benefits. So that is my goal. I want to now fast forward to 2022 and 2023 when I started the position in mid-November and what steps we have taken in the last 3 months. So we really are in a crisis. We are crisis management and we are triaging right now. And so several strategies have been started and they're outlined on this slide. First is that we applied for a federal waiver to waive the interviews. Again, that is a time savings to our staff. Our IT system, we were able to, before I get to the IT systems, in November, at the end of November, we have a dedicated team of eligibility technicians that are focusing on processing the recertifications. And that's what has generated a lot of the media attention and the frustration is the lack of the benefits, and it's those recertifications. With that dedicated team, they have been focusing on processing those applications. In addition, with our IT staff, they were able to focus on reprogramming the IT legacy system known as the Eligibility Information System, EIS, and they were able to roll the SNAP benefits for February, March, and April. Essentially, what this did was it allowed us a stopgap. So we have a beginning and we have an end. So the recertifications for November, December, and January is essentially the backlog that we have right now. It's around 5,000 recertifications. The dedicated team is manually processing those applications. With the dedicated team, we are estimating it's probably going to take 2 months for them to go through processing those applications. Alaskans will receive those benefits. We are doing everything that we can to process them as quickly as we can. It takes about an average of 1 hour to process one of those SNAP applications, which is why we had to do multiple strategies to stop it and to have our IT staff reprogram so it rolls for 3 months, and then we can really have a dedicated team to processing that backlog. The third strategy is Alaska has a six-month certification period. One of the federal recommendations is to move to a 12-month certification period. So we have contractors in place, and they are working on reprogramming our IT systems to move from a six-month to a 12-month certification period. Again, that means that eligibility technician, instead of reaching out and talking to that client twice a year, they will be talking to them once a year to re-verify their financial status and the qualifications for that step. All of these multiple strategies are happening right now. I want to pause and see if there's any questions.
You're done with this slide? Slide four? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that rundown. I think there are some decision points that may not have been in the summary, and that's the nature of summary, but I hearken back to the 2018 Ombudsman's Report. There aren't any surprises at all here. So I have a couple of maybe more detailed questions. And for starters, you say a SNAP application takes about an hour to process. Is that for an eligibility tech 1 or an eligibility tech 3? And how many of those do you have?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Keel, that's a great question. So we have in total, I believe it's a little over 130 eligibility technicians, 2s and 3s. Those are the individuals that can actually process the application. Eligibility technician 1s are receiving those paper applications, scanning them into our document management system. So it takes all of our eligibility technicians, they each have a role in this process.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And is that your target number of folks processing, or are we working toward a higher or a lower number?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I think what you're getting at is, do we have a sufficient workforce? Is that correct?
I wouldn't, Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't mind an answer to that question, too.
Okay. So I am going to talk a little bit on the next slide on workforce and what we're doing right now. So we are actively trying to recruit additional eligibility technicians. And if we can wait to the next slide, I'll give you those details. I would say, though, in 2018, I did work with Kate Burkhart with the Ombudsman. We had several meetings together to review the report. And I actually reached out to a lot of the direct providers, and I answered the phone and talked to Alaskans who are impacted by this backlog. I'm very hands-on, and I've been to an Anchorage DPA office, so I could actually sit with an eligibility technician and watch the process and what they go through. And I do extend the invite if any of you would like to sit with an eligibility technician. We are happy to schedule a tour where you can meet and talk with an eligibility technician. I think all of this is the issues that were raised in 2018 have not been fully addressed in the Ombudsman report. We are working on a workforce. There were strategies that were put in place. As an example, there's a document management system. So in 2018, there was a backlog, but it was the paper applications. And so addressing that, the solution was the online document management system. So our eligibility technicians receive that paper application, scan the document in, and that's connected into another system that's called workflow management that our eligibility technicians 2s and 3s use. I would say that these systems aren't all integrated, and that's part of the issue that we struggle with. And so in order to reduce error rates and to increase timely applications, we need to have those IT systems functioning integrated together. They're functioning, but they need to be integrated together. I would also say that in 2018, there was a lot of complaints that Alaskans that are don't have a public assistance office. And so there was a lot of frustrations on lack of communication. And so that is the virtual contact center known as the VCC was implemented. And the intent is that it's really about equity, that if you have access to an office or a virtual office, that every Alaskan, regardless of your community, would be able to drive to or pick up the phone and call the virtual call center or talk to an eligibility technician to help process that application. I think the virtual contact center, the VCC, is a great idea. It's not fully staffed. And so I'm going to talk about one of those strategies on the next slide. But it was successful in the early months until the backlog happened. And that's when we had, and I'll again talk on the next slide, we need to engage in a short-term temporary contract to address making sure that we can answer the phone, receive the information from the Alaskan, and then provide updates on the status of their application to then move it to the next stage. So again, multiple strategies, we're working on it. I can't change the past, but I can own what happens now going into the future and the resources that we have moving into the future.
Any questions on this slide before we go to the much anticipated next one? Okay, go on to number 5, please.
So I want to break slide 5 for the record. Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. Slide 5, I want to break into sort of 3 groups. The first is I want to talk about 4 strategies that are already in place, and then I'm going to talk about 2 strategies that are going to be implemented within the next 90 days, and then the third strategy, which is long-term, we're going to see that in the next 12 months or so. So first, it's paramount about focusing on recruitment and retention of employees. And so since November of 2022, we have filled 71 vacant positions. That represents both permanent and long-term positions. As of February this month, we have 31 new employees that are in various stages of training. We have a remaining 55 vacancies. We do have positions posted on Workplace Alaska. I think because of the media attention, we are seeing large volumes of applicants compared to other programs within the department, which is good news. It's just the reviewing of the applications, the hiring, and then the onboarding. We're staggering out right now. So again, this is a huge focus of effort we have. In the governor's amended operating budget, we did request 30 additional long-term, non-perm positions, and that is specifically for supporting our redetermination process. Now, I would say that it also benefits, you know, when an eligibility technician talks to an Alaskan, they're going to take care of all of their applications at once, so it will have positive impacts to the other public assistance programs. I just want to pause. Is there any questions on workforce?
We'll just go through the slide and then we'll take questions.
Okay. The second is workplace safety. There's a lot of frustrated Alaskans, and unfortunately, we have had some threats to our staff, and workplace safety is paramount. So we did, we have a contract with security guards that are able to de-escalate clients and engage in medical emergencies. Those security guards are in our four larger offices. In addition, we have a small contract just to do an assessment on security for our 11 offices to provide feedback on how we can make sure it's a more secure place and safe place for our clients and our employees. The third is we have a small contract for crisis communication. We've had a lot of inquiries from media and from Alaskans, and we just need help messaging sort of what caused the backlog, what is the department doing in managing expectations, and so we have that additional support. And then finally, I want to speak to Monday, it was announced that it was $1.68 million that was granted to the food banks, and I want to talk a little bit about what that is. So in the 2021 capital appropriation, it was given, there was $6 million that was given to the Department of Fish and Game. Fish and Game RSA'd $1.68 million to Homeland Security and Emergency Management to purchase shelf-stable food. Homeland Security and Emergency Management had not purchased that shelf-stable food because they didn't have a warehouse in order to store that volume of food. Because of the imminent food insecurities that Alaskans are facing, and in conversations with the governor, that is where there was a conversation of RSAing that $1.68 million from Fish and Game to the Department of Health. And that's when we had two existing grants that we were able to amend to get the funding out to the food banks. The food banks have a hub and spoke system. So the grant is going to the Food Bank of Alaska and the Fairbanks Community Food Bank. But they are partnering with the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank and the Southeast Alaska Food Bank, in addition to the other 150 food pantries. The goal and intent was the funding was identified. 7 days later, we were able to work through the RSA, work through amending the grant, getting the money out. That's Herculean, if you know our bureaucracy systems. And the funding last Thursday was granted to these food banks. They are currently working on the plan of bulk purchasing food and purchasing money cards or gift cards so that Alaskans impacted by the backlog can go to a food bank, get one of those cards, and use those cards for the local grocery stores. We know there's a strong connection between the SNAP program and the local economy and the grocery stores. And so we want to make sure that we are connecting those two together. These ideas came from the food banks. And so currently right now, those four are actively working with the other food banks to create the plan. So it's multifactorial. I would defer questions to them as they are working through this process right now.
Do we have any questions on slide 5? Senator Gill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Designee, you said there's, I think, 54 applicants, and the slide says continuous recruitment. So Workplace Alaska has 3. Can you talk to us about the constraints on that hiring effort?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Gill, that's a great question. So that there are continuous recruitments, so we're seeing large volumes of applications. It's for a fraud investigator, eligibility technician 1, and eligibility technician 2. So I believe it's the 3 current job postings that we have right now. And the cohorting that's happening, depending on the job class, is focusing on, the applications are reviewed, and then we have a training program. We're right now working on additional conversations and strategies on how do we increase the bandwidth of the training team so that we can train more eligibility technicians. Right now it's limited to 14, but we're in conversations right now to figure out how can we open up that aperture for increasing the training program.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along the lines of Senator Kiel's questions in terms of the vacancies, the hiring process went from DOA to DOH, from the Department of Administration to the Department of Health. Has that been fully implemented yet for the hiring process?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'm going to defer that question over to Assistant Commissioner Josie Stern.
For the record, Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner, the department was delegated authority for recruitment last week. We had transferred over positions to Department of Administration during the human resources consolidation, and the department received one recruitment position back. We are taking over the recruitment efforts, and we are having the divisions assist with range 16 recruitments.
And just follow up from that question, Mr. Chair. Since assist seems to be more of an emergent situation, has DOA offered to give you more assistance and more personnel to help out with this? Is that something that can be done and should be done?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'll take that question. I think that's a great question. I can circle back with the Department of Administration. They have been very helpful with us as we're trying to get procurement through and HR. I think it's a bandwidth, but we can follow up.
And
well, go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. How long does it take, again, to train a eligibility to technician to be able to enter or to certify eligibility for SNAP beneficiaries?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's a great question. So the training is actually extensive. It's 2 years. There's 18 different public assistance programs. It's very time intensive, hence why, you know, we can't just easily hire 55 employees and turn around in a week, deploy them to training. There's a staged process because of the complexity of the public assistance program. SNAP is one of the most complex programs to determine eligibility. And so the training team was able to shrink it down to 2 months specifically for SNAP to do basic things. And I think it's really, you know, lining up the eligibility technicians so they each have a skill set so we can pass through those applications as quickly as possible. Definitely room for improvement. There's a lot of needs in that space.
And can we talk a little bit, Mr. Chair, about the what's the minimum qualifications for an eligibility technician and their range of pay? If it takes 2 years to get someone trained, should this be doing everything we can make sure we don't have that type of turnover? Because that's a long commitment to get someone from hire to fully trained and implemented.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's a great question. We actually have Director Deb Etheridge online, and she can talk about the minimum qualifications for the eligibility technicians.
Yes, Ms. Etheridge, if you could help. Can Mr. Designee with that question, please?
For the record, this is Deb Etheridge, Director of the Division of Public Assistance. The minimum qualifications for our eligibility technician includes a high school diploma and years of experience.
Ms. Etheridge, what's the range of pay? What's for that starting position for eligibility technician two?
To the chair, this is Deb Etheridge, Director of Public Assistance, and I will have to get back to the committee on the range of pay.
All right.
Follow-up questions?
Oh, yes, Mr. Chair. A new question. On the governor's $1.6 million to be distributed, was that the total amount that Fish and Game had to give to the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs? Or do they have more funding that this is just a portion of that funding?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, my understanding is that was the total amount.
And
go ahead.
On the SNAP, we asked this question, and you guys didn't have this last on Monday, but just what's the total cost for a monthly SNAP cost to the state of Alaska on a monthly basis?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, again, Director Deb Etheridge will be able to answer that question. And I just wanted to note for the committee, the Director Etheridge has started this. She's on week 7, so she's on a steep learning curve. So she's scrambling, but she is learning, and she's doing a great job. Thank you.
Ms. Etheridge, if you could help Senator Wilson with that question, please.
To the chair, this is Deb Etheridge, Director of the Division of Public Assistance. Our average benefit per household for the SNAP program is $559.49, with an average benefit per person of $242.21. We have an average monthly recipients of 94,645 individuals. And if you look at our average monthly benefits for all recipients, it's $29,605,934.
So just doing the rough math, that's less than 10% of beneficiaries that are going to be benefited from this direct food bank pantries, which is a good start, Mr. Chair. I'm just concerned that won't serve enough individuals across the state of Alaska. We should look for more opportunities to fix this center.
We have other questions on Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad to hear about the security contracts. Can you talk to us about, because I think that's a major issue with the retention of workers. Can you talk to us about when the department started hearing from staff about feeling unsafe at work?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, thank you for that question. So I started the position November 16th, and I think I had three, and I listened to the recordings, I hear the words, and so we had about three. It started around August, and that was correlated with the backlog. I think it's hard, I did ask the staff going back, is this a historic problem? And they said they can't remember that it being a historic problem, but also this division has the highest turnover rate within the department. And we had a pandemic and there was a lot of virtual working. And so it's really hard to correlate if this is historic or if this is new. But we have seen an increase in threats since August, which is why we engaged in a security assessment and security guards to keep our staff safe.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, the department staff have been telling their superiors and the previous commissioner's telephone town halls that they were feeling unsafe for a couple of years now.
Just one.
Senator Wilson.
Just one more question, Mr. Chair. On the SNAP backlog, has it caused any other issues with other systems, with food assistance programs like WIC? Has it caused any systems issues with other systems along the public assistance line that we should be aware of?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, yes, there are other public assistance programs that are negatively impacted because of the prioritization of the SNAP backlog.
And just follow up, is there anything that we should be able, that the committee should be aware of, or legislature in terms of future systems failures because of the stress on those systems?
So through the chair, Senator Wilson, I think that is before us today. We have a capital request so that we can finally address the IT legacy systems. And I think slide 8 will talk about the milestones and where we want to go. In addition, I think it's the recruitment, retention of our staff and building staff morale. I've held three town halls specifically with the Division of Public Assistance. The fourth was canceled due to weather yesterday. but I think connecting with staff, hearing their concerns, and making sure that they are heard and they are addressed is really important to address the retention. So I think it's all hands on deck. There's multiple strategies that we're working through right now. But yes, there is an ask before you.
Okay, on that, maybe you can help the committee. I guess there's a future request that you're going to talk about here in the presentation. And also you had mentioned that there's a supplemental request. And we meet every winter to try to get ahead of problems and fund things. So help me with why these responses are coming in supplementals and they weren't put in the regular budget submission in December, because apparently this, at least it appears that this collapse in the system was a slow train wreck, and helped the committee why the department wasn't ahead of it, and in particular why this wasn't included, these weren't included in the original budget submission.
To the chair, that's a great question. And I think that there was some deficits in communication and realizing the total impacts. When Alaskans started to reach out directly to the department, that's when there was a changeover between commissioners. And that's when, on my very first day, that's when I started to hear about the backlog and really diving in to understanding the system problems and the larger impacts.
Okay, so I understand you're new to the position, but the entity's been around for decades. And the concern still is, why isn't this information brought to the legislature before we have a virtual collapse, so we can try to get in front of it? And I recognize that you're new to the position, but that still doesn't preclude, you know, the information getting through the budget submission process, at least, so the legislature can have that discussion on appropriating funds, because that's really our only tool here, is the appropriation side. We don't manage the agencies, but we can't fund repairs if we don't know there's something wrong. That's the concern. So it's not directed at you, it's directed at the agency itself. So can you help me understand why the agency can't get us information with problems that are coming at them? And to the earlier question, apparently now we're going to have a ripple effect of other challenges within the department. So can you ensure the committee here that we're not going to need additional funding or assistance to deal with the repercussions of concentration on this one solution and jeopardizing other areas? Because we want to look at it holistically. And we're not, frankly, that concerned on what it costs. We're always concerned about the total dollars. But we're not afraid of problems and big cost numbers and try to work through the system. So is this proposal that we're going to have, this is it and it fixes the problem, or we're going to have more surprises?
To the chair, those are all really good comments, and I definitely take them to heart. My job that I have before me right now is gathering as much information, triage and assessing what the problems are, and thinking longitudinally what we need to do, what are the resources that we need. We know that we need to address the IT systems, that we need to support our staff, and we need to make sure that our staff have efficient processes in place in expanding the training. I think that this operating request in the governor's amended budget and the capital request in the amended budget definitely addresses the majority of the issues. Is there unknowns? There may be. I cannot guarantee that there isn't an unknown. But I do commit to open conversations, and when there are problems addressed, I do want to work with the legislature to resolve those problems.
To the chair, for the record as well, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and I just want to add, in relation to the government budget, I know we're going to speak through that in later slides, but some of that has to do with the Medicaid redetermination process. And the timeline and kind of the federal, I would say, federal announcement through the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2023 that really articulated when that process would need to occur, what the extent of that process would be, and what states needed to do to become compliant with that process, passed in late December. So that was after the first budget had been submitted. And so kind of the resources that we envision, that we believe we need at this point, that those have been kind of developed after we had guidance from the federal government on what it was exactly that we were going to be required to do. To be frank, that guidance is still ongoing. I mean, there are still updates every week from CMS, and we're communicating with them very regularly, but trying to align those requirements that are both technical and staffing in nature, along with the challenges that we are seeing with the Division of Public Assistance, has been an iterative process. And so, you know, there are still outstanding questions, I think, that we have, and we're trying to resolve as quickly as we can. in terms of making sure the resources we believe we need align with the level of effort that we are looking at beginning with in April. But there's some assumptions that we won't necessarily know until that process starts. And I'll talk about those a little bit more in the presentation. But that's some of the timing that contributes to the GovAmend request.
So we're starting our subcommittee process. And Senator Wilson always has an interest in the subject matter, along with myself. So I'd like to make sure that the department gives the subcommittee as accurate information on the problem they're facing as possible, and not be hiding potential future impacted cost issues from the committee. And again, I don't care what the numbers are. I just want the subcommittee to have them so we can try to deal with it, so we can get our arms around this. Having situations like this face the public, I think, are unacceptable. You know, we've got the resources, financial resources, to go after these problems if we just know they exist. So I just would encourage you to be forthright with the subcommittee, and in particular the repercussions of your concentration to fix these problems, so we look at it again holistically.
Thank you, sir. As a follow-up to a prior question, I just want to state on the record that an eligibility technician, the starting wage is between $22.50 to $24.
Okay. So we'll go on to next slide, please.
For the record, Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health. The slide before you shows the budgetary requests associated with the Division of Public Assistance. The December 15th budget requested a continuance of an FY 2023 appropriation for 20 long-term non-perms to support application processing.
We have to breathe that easily. Come back on the record. For those watching at home, we just had to synchronize our presentation with the presenter to make sure everything runs smooth. So go ahead, and we're going to start here on page 6.
For the record, Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health. The slide before you shows the budgetary requests associated with the Division of Public Assistance. The first item is the request from the December 15th governor's budget for fiscal year 2024, and that is a continuance of an FY 2023 appropriation for $1.3 million for 20 long-term non-permanent positions to support application processing. The department also added 10 IT positions in departmental support services to support the reprogramming efforts. The February 14th governor amended budget for supplemental requested a $3.1 million unrestricted general fund transfer for Medicaid services to the Division for Public Assistance for Medicaid eligibility redetermination and public assistance application processing. That now comes with $3.7 million in federal fund match. This item will also support 30 long-term non-permanent positions that the division would like to hire to support the application processing. The other item is a February 14th FY 2024 capital project, which is $54.2 million for a full mainframe system replacement to go into the Integrated Eligibility Enterprise System. That amount is broken into around $30.2 million in federal funding, $17.2 million in general fund match, and an estimated $6.9 million in reappropriations.
The capital budget chairman's not here today, so I'm sure he'll take a look at that and we'll deal with it. We have any other questions on the request? So there's maybe talk to us a little bit about how soon you need those funds outside of the capital budget request.
To the chair, the funding for the supplemental would be needed before the end of the fiscal year.
Okay, so we'll work with the OMB and the department on that. We haven't decided yet if we're going to do a streamlined quick, which we call a fast track supplemental. And so we're hoping that that can be avoided, but I'm not sure if that's the case. Not avoiding your expenditure request, but avoiding the need for the political ramifications of trying to do a fast track supplemental budget. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, you know, looking through here, it looks like, you know, capital requests would be about a five-year timeline, probably a five-year timeline, looks like, to get your IT systems fully up and going. What I think is missing here in terms of your sort of your timelines and requests is I don't see anything talking about a capital or a funding request to look at a systems redesign of your current training and sort of application process. I mean, if it takes, you know, at least 2 months to get me trained or 2 years to get me fully trained, and I just need a high school diploma making $24 an hour at max, I could do a lot less work and get paid the same amount of wage somewhere else. And it just seems that you would still have the same systematic problem occur later on in the future if you have a large staffing turnover at any point in time, that this problem will just pop up again. You know, I think that the state of Alaska is a horse and cart system, and we just care about getting to point A to point B, and, you know, the horse died with air, you know, the system crashing, Mr. Chair, and we're pulling it along, but I see this horse dying again if we can't fix the staffing situation, and, you know, we're on the Oregon Trail, and little Susie now has this area, and, you know, the oxen's is, you know, we're trying to get to Oregon, and we can't get there because we don't have the proper tools and systems in place. And Mr. Chair, I'm just worried that if we don't have a redesign of the workflow to make it a little bit easier for the staffing systems and the application process that's not discussed here and hasn't been discussed here recently. I know I'm throwing this on this. The department probably hasn't looked at these situations yet, but this is just a major concern that I have.
Yeah, sounds like something for the subcommittee to work on.
So through the chair, I can actually answer part of that question because, Senator Wilson, you do bring up a really good point. For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. Three answers. In 2017, and Mr. Nick Faulkner will talk about this on slide 8, we engaged with our federal partners. They came in and supported us in a technical plan that created the roadmap. It's a 5 milestones, and it lays the foundation of how we're going to move off of the mainframe, off of EIS, and address the system issues in ARIES. So that plan is in place, and that's what we've been following since 2017. In terms of workflow process, I don't know the exact year. We can get back to the committee, but there's a system. The vendor is called Current, and the system is called Workflow Management. And that supports the eligibility technicians as they are processing applications. That system was not fully implemented during the pandemic. As our new director has been working very closely with our federal partners, the Food Nutrition Services, FNS, they linked us to the state of Nevada. Nevada has that exact same workflow system. Nevada was the worst in the state. They fully embraced that technology, and now they're ranked number 14. So that was something that was identified by our new director last week. And later today, we have a meeting with them to understand what are the steps it's going to take to fully realize the system that we already have in place. So I think that we do have some tools to address some of the concerns that you brought up. But I think this is just the time as we are sort of in a crisis management and triaging all of these different situations and scenarios.
So currently, it takes about 9 different systems, 9 screens for an eligibility technician to work through. Mm-hmm. Will the presentation later on talk upon the time frames of when those screens will be down from 9 to 5 to 4 to just 1?
So through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'm going to defer that question to Nick Faulkner, and he's going to talk about that on slide 8.
Okay, we can wait. Thank you.
Okay, we'll wait till we get to slide 8. We're on earlier slide. Any other questions before we go to slide 7? Slide 7, please.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. Slide 7, what I would like to do is talk about the 3 appropriations the Division of Public Assistance received, talk about the intent of the funding and who it serves. I'm going to defer all of the financial questions to Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner, and all the IT technical questions to Mr. Nick Faulkner. I would also state that on slide 8, it really goes in depth in the milestones, which links back to funding in these various appropriations. So in FY13, the legislature appropriated 8.7 million UGF, and through that appropriation, we were able to leverage 65.8 million in federal. That created the ARES system. In 2014, the ARES system went live, and that funded the Medicaid, it supported the 2,000 Alaskans that are on a Medicaid. When the system went live in 2014, there were system flaws in ARES. One of the lessons learned back in 2014 was that it was a single contractor, and while the contractor matched the contract deliverables, there were flawed issues. And so that's where, as I mentioned prior, we asked for federal support. And in 2017, the roadmap was created to address those system issues in ARES and create a path forward for getting off of the mainframe that has EIS, the Eligibility Information System, and to move forward. The appropriation in FY19, the legislature appropriated 9 million UGF to leverage 27.7 million federal dollars. 2 of those tasks are complete, the unified search module and the automated renewal functionality. The third element of that appropriation is actually we are drafting an RFP that will go through. We hope to have a contractor selected by fall of 2023. That contractor will use the remaining balance of FY19 to migrate all of the non-MAGI Medicaid programs to the new eligibility enrollment system. In addition, it's also we are moving the ARES system into the cloud, and that will be completed by June of 2023. So moving on to FY23, there's actually 2 capital appropriations in FY23. There's only 1 that's listed on the slide. We apologize for that error. So the first appropriation, the legislature appropriated 4.7 million UGF that leveraged the 18.8 million federal dollars. That funding was to start the milestones 3, 4, and 5 that Mr. Nick Faulkner will talk about in slide 8. The 8 million capital appropriation was to pay for the e-forms for all of the public assistance applications, and it is also launching the online SNAP application by December 2023. So some of that funding has already been used, and it is encumbered for those specific projects. Before you today is our governor amended request, which is we're requesting 17.1 million GF, a 6.9 million reappropriation to leverage the 30.1 million federal dollars which will finish milestones 3, 4, and 5. And that what that means is it fully decommissions the mainframe eligibility system, and it migrates all of the public assistance programs into the brand new eligibility enrollment system. In addition, it provides a secured access for self-service portal. So Alaskans, again, you know, we will always have DPA offices that they can go into. In addition, they can go to their computer and they can use that self-service portal to apply for their public assistance. All of this has been managed by a team of 5 state employees in the project management office within the Division of Public Assistance.
Here we have questions on this. Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that you still had money left in FY19. How much is left from FY19, and how much is the capital projects left in FY, I guess, going on? That was unspent. Sorry.
For the record, Josie Sternis, Assistant Commissioner, through the chair to Senator Wilson. The FY19 appropriation has around $20 million left unobligated. The large portion is federal. There's about $16.5 million federal left, and the remainder, $4.4 million general fund. And then for FY23, the department of the $23.5 million appropriation, around $23 million is unobligated, $18.3 million in federal, and $4.7 million in general fund.
Follow up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm a little confused then. And so FY24, the capital ask, is the federal $30 million, is that the remaining amounts of some of these other funds, or is that in addition to those funds?
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, that's in addition to the prior year appropriations.
So if I could, Mr. Chair, it looks like that's about roughly almost $200 million from FY13, and roughly $130 million has been spent, but we still have this huge problem, and that's just a large sum of money to get this IT system up and going, Mr. Chair.
Right. It looks like about $180 million in a decade. It's a sizable amount of change. And this might not be the end of it.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could, one more
question
then. So in FY19, why do we have, you know, $20 million unspent? I know this predates a lot of you guys here at the table, but it just seems that in FY19, we should have done more to fix this problem, because $20 million is a large chunk of change not to just leave on the table and not to start implementing systems. And the same for FY23. That we're currently in.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I agree with you. As I had mentioned during the SNAP timeline, the unprecedented global pandemic and the Department then of Health and Social Services leading the efforts on the state COVID response, it really impacted procurement. All of the procurement staff were really focused on procuring for COVID, in addition to getting all of the federal dollars out to communities and to Alaskans. This is an example of the negative ramifications of not being able to secure those contracts in years earlier.
Just follow up. I understand COVID. I don't think that was – COVID didn't really hit to FY19 starting calendar year 18. And so that was predated COVID. I think this problem started before COVID. We had an opportunity to fix it before COVID, and I don't want COVID to be the excuse of why things just weren't done in the programs. So again, I know that this predates you guys, and you're not, you know, solely responsible for this situation, but I think this predates COVID, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll go on to slide number 8.
So Mr. Nick Faulkner, he's a project manager. He will present on slide 8.
Okay, Mr. Faulkner, can you help us with slide 8?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nick Faulkner. I am the project manager for the Eligibility System Roadmap Modernization Effort. And I've got a slide here that describes a little bit of the history of the transition from the legacy system, as well as the remaining milestones moving forward to fully move off of the mainframe and to a modern modular eligibility enrollment system. So as we've spoken about, the EIS system originally went live in 1983. It is a COBOL mainframe system. It's relatively old, obviously, and has a lot of deficiencies as far as efficiencies for workers. So in 2011, an effort was started to work on what was then called ARES. That was a system that was intended to bring forward the MAGI Medicaid program into a modernized system. So in that time frame between 2011 and 2014, ARES went live. It contained the MAGI Medicaid program, which, as previously mentioned, serves about 200,000 or slightly over 200,000 Alaskans every month. It also was the system that Medicaid expansion was built into. So those two things went live in 2014 and then shortly after, of course, with Medicaid expansion. In 2017, due to our experiences with our previous vendor, we knew we needed to take a different approach to the way that we were approaching systems development and IT implementation. We partnered with some federal partners to kind of work through a better way and developed what we call the Alaska Product Eligibility Modernization Roadmap. That roadmap is a 5-milestone effort, and it focuses on smaller, more agile, modular procurements that are intended to lower the risk that we face with these large, multi-year IT project timelines, as well as to provide benefits to Alaskans and to workers faster. So we are intending not to have to wait until, you know, the end of the project to deploy, but we are routinely making improvements and ranking changes in a smaller, more iterative way. As I mentioned on the bottom of the slide there, you'll see that this is a multi-year effort. There are 5 to 6 milestones. The first 2 milestones are enhanced and streamlined worker experience. Those include things like what we call unified search, which is a system that allows a worker to search multiple systems to pull back information about a client or an applicant to be able to answer questions and provide assistance. It also includes the automated renewals functionality, which is going to be critical when we move into redeterminations for Medicaid later this year. It allows the worker to have less manual intervention and for data sources, external data sources, to be checked to confirm eligibility. Next up, also underway is the non-MAGI Medicaid categories. That is currently in the procurement phase, and we hope to start that work later this year. The remaining 3 milestones that you'll see listed here are the migration of the SNAP program off of the existing EIS mainframe system, additional improvements in case processing and communication with our federal partners, reporting, other items in there, some pretty big enhancements for workers and applicants. And then lastly, you'll see the TANF and CASH programs migrating off the EIS mainframe. The goal of this roadmap is at the end of this process, all of the public assistance programs will be out of the mainframe system and into a modular, modern, flexible public assistance eligibility and enrollment system.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Nick, you talked a little bit here about the enhanced streamlined worker experience. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how soon a worker will go from 9 screens to 1 screen? And would that speed up the training experience as well for that individual?
Yeah, certainly through the chair. I will say that the we have already put some improvements in production. They're already there for workers today. They're relatively new, but we put those in. I'll highlight our search functionality, as I mentioned. Having multiple systems is challenging, clearly, for workers. One of the things we wanted to do to make their experience more streamlined was to provide a system where they can gather information on multiple systems in one centralized place. Certainly, we are still facing multiple systems for other purposes, but at least for looking up information, we wanted to kind of put that out there for users. That is out now. Users are using that system and are reporting positive changes there. The other thing I'll highlight very, very soon that workers will be able to use is our automated renewals process. That automated renewals process, as I stated, allows a certain amount of Medicaid renewals to be processed no touch by workers. So workers will not have to interact with those ex parte renewals on an ongoing basis, taking some of the workload off of them on the day-to-day.
Okay. Follow up?
Yes, follow up. Thank you for that, Nick. You're talking a little low and a little fast. That could be slowed down a little bit for the next question here. You mentioned that Nevada was number 14 in the country. Who's number 1, 2, and 3, and what systems are they using? And is any of the top 10 states currently using ARIES?
Through the chair, I don't know that I have an answer for that question for you today. We can certainly look into it and get back to you.
Follow up?
And I guess this might be for the department. Are we at risk for any federal penalties for losing some of these certifications and delays? And if so, do you have a guesstimate amount of how much we might be looking at? Will that come as a supplemental or next year's request in the budget?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, so I think when it comes to the SNAP program, there are sanctions that the Food Nutrition Services can apply to us. We are in a corrective action plan with them, and we are meeting weekly with them. And so while they have the tools that they could leverage financial penalties, we are not anticipating them leveraging financial penalties. When it comes to Medicaid, they're under different rules, and I'll defer that question to Deputy Emily Ritchie.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, for the record, this is Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. There are certain requirements that we have to meet for the redetermination process that I'll talk about a little bit later on in the presentation. Some of those requirements are new, and they not only apply to the redetermination effort, but they will apply to general Medicaid eligibility processing moving forward. And so part of what we need to consider is areas where we are not able to meet those requirements currently. We need to articulate to CMS what our mitigation plan is, and then we need to demonstrate that we are taking serious action to work towards those mitigation efforts. And so there's 40 other states that are also developing mitigation plans right now because those requirements are challenging for most states. I will say most of the requirements that currently we are not able to meet are associated with the EIS system, and those enrollments, those Medicaid enrollments that are stored on that system. So it's going to be important to move those off of the EIS system into an ARIES system within a three-year time frame is right now what CMS is looking at. But some of that guidance is still forthcoming.
Thank you. And one more.
We'll follow up.
There was talks upon we had a one-vendor situation. The state sometimes has one-vendor situations within the Department of Health that sometimes fails to live up to the guidance or the contractual agreements. With this integrated enrollment system underway, I understand there's multiple vendors that could provide these services. Is there anything that we could do to work with multiple vendors simultaneously to speed this process up?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's exactly what we're engaging in right now, is multiple vendors. So again, it reduces the risk of single vendor failure. And we have a competitive price, and I think that globally, holistically, the department's learned a lot from the 2014 ARIES rollout and the flaws in that contract. And so there are measures in place to prevent that, and I think with Deputy Emily Ritchie's experience with contract management and just making sure that we have those stop gaps in place for accountability, it really sets us up in a better position for this new capital request with additional vendors that are smaller focused. That's why we have a dedicated project management team that can manage multiple projects at the same time. Again, so that while we say 2018, if we can collapse that down even faster, that would be great. But that's the timeline that we have set out right now.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So Ms. Holt Hedberg, help me with Mr. Faulkner. Is he an employee of the state? I see he's located out of Arizona. Is he just traveling, or does he? What's going on there?
Through the chair, no. He's one of our contractors.
Okay, so he resides in Phoenix, and he's just a contract.
Correct.
Okay. We'll go on now to number 10, page 10. We've got 50 minutes, and we're about halfway through. I think we got 9 pages, so I'll start speeding this up if we start running out of time, so you ladies don't have to come back tomorrow.
Senator Stedman, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and I will go through this as fast as reasonably possible, given the subject matter content. So we're going to spend the next few slides talking about I basically oversee all of the different divisions and sections that make up the state's Medicaid program, and started just a week before Commissioner Hedberg. And the next couple of slides, we're going to talk about the Medicaid redetermination process and what that means for Alaskans. So moving to slide 10, I want to talk a little bit about the unwinding of what has been referred to as the unwinding of the continuous enrollment for Medicaid. And essentially in 2020, as part of the federal government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, they included requirements in the Family First Coronavirus Response Act that states maintain continuous eligibility for Medicaid enrollees and really not engage in the standard 12-month, you know, redetermination process that would occur. So those were suspended in 2020, and recognizing that states would see an increase in enrollment and associated costs with the Medicaid program, the federal government provided 6.2% enhanced federal match, or what we call EFMAP, to help offset the cost. So the state has been receiving, all states have been receiving that funding in essentially to help offset the cost for maintaining enrollment. Because that was tied to the ending of the federal public health emergency, throughout 2020, there was a lot of speculation about when the federal government would end the federal public health emergency, what that would mean for states, but particularly what that would mean for Medicaid beneficiaries and the ending of this continuous enrollment. And there was significant speculation and concern about how much time states would have to prepare for the ending of these requirements. In late December of 2022, the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2023 was passed, and that effectively severed the ending of the continuous enrollment requirements from the ending of the federal public health emergency and provided, for the first time, some clear guidance and a timeline for states in terms of what they could expect with the ending of this continuous enrollment period. So it also outlined a phase-down approach of the enhanced federal funding match, which again is at 6.2% and will begin phasing down effective April 1 of this year. So in order to retain that enhanced FMAP, states are required to complete redeterminations subject to certain requirements and within certain timeframes. So the continuous enrollment period ends effectively March 31st of 2022. So beginning April or 2023, excuse me, it takes me about 6 months to actually correctly say the year we're in. So starting April 1st of 2023, Alaska and all other states will begin Medicaid eligibility redeterminations. So there's currently about 263,000 enrolled beneficiaries in the Medicaid program. And so Alaska will have 12 months beginning April 1st to initiate redeterminations for all active Medicaid cases. States will have 14 months from April 1st to complete redeterminations. So 12 months to initiate redeterminations and 14 months to complete determinations. As I said earlier in the presentation, there are some additional requirements in the Consolidated Appropriations Act that are intended to be permanent for states regarding how they manage eligibility and their eligibility systems. And so within the last, I want to say, 2 to 3 weeks, CMS has provided further guidance to states outlining that they will have 2 years after the ending of the unwinding period. And the exact date is a little ambiguous. I understand we'll receive more clarity in the upcoming weeks to ensure their systems comply with the permanent requirements that were outlined in the Consolidated Appropriations Act. So I'm thinking about kind of three different deadlines in my head, right? One is to complete redeterminations by June 1 of 2024, and then the other is 2 years after that to make sure our systems meet the requirements that are outlined in that piece of legislation. And we'll talk a little bit more about where those are and what those gaps are in the future. So moving on to slide 11. Assistant Commissioner Josie Stern will speak to this slide.
For the record, Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health. This slide represents the budgetary requests related to Medicaid. On December 15th in the FY 2024 governor's budget, the division requested $18.1 million related to Medicaid utilization and inflation, which reflects various rate increases that are both federally and state driven. The February 14th Governor's Amendment Supplemental requests the $3.1 million unrestricted general fund transfer from Medicaid to public assistance. And then the February 14th FY 2024 Governor's Amend Budget requests an additional $24.4 million in unrestricted general funds related to the Medicaid increases from the enhanced federal medical assistance percentage step down that Deputy Commissioner Ricci spoke about earlier, as well as some additional rate rebasing. The last item is the $17.8 million for Medicaid and public assistance eligibility redeterminations. And that will also come with 30 long-term non-permanent positions in the Division of Public Assistance as a carry-on from the FY23 supplemental request.
Okay. For the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. So this outlines Alaska's redetermination schedule. As stated earlier, we'll have 12 months beginning April 1st to undertake redetermination for 263,000 Alaskans, which is over a third of Alaska's population. So this is a tremendous effort. We do have some requirements in terms of how many redeterminations the states can initiate in any given month. There are limits. There are kind of minimums to what we must start and limits to how many we can undertake every month. What we've outlined here is a schedule that envisions kind of a slower ramp up to full capacity for redetermination. So you'll see in April, May, and June, we're proposing beginning at about half capacity, so at about nearly 11,000 redeterminations per month, increasing in July and August, and then kind of reaching our kind of mature redetermination effort in September through March. There's a couple of reasons for this. I think one is, as Commissioner Designee Hedberg stated earlier, we are experiencing the impacts of the SNAP backlog across several different programs, including Medicaid programs and enrollment. And so we want to make sure that our teams are prepared and staffed to support this. Two, this is a large undertaking. We have new systems that have been programmed and been tested, and I'll talk about those in the next slide. But we want to make sure that we understand how those are working. And some of those systems, which Mr. Faulkner spoke about earlier, are new systems that can result in some, I think, really helpful automation. But there's a lot of outstanding questions about how many of these redeterminations will be processed automatically and how many will have to be processed manually. So we want to get a sense of what that is. And then we are also really trying to identify how we can work with different external partners that engage with our Medicaid beneficiaries, whether that's tribal health organizations, the hospital association, federally qualified health centers, to see if we can leverage some of the work that they're already doing to assist our technicians in making these redeterminations. So starting with a slow ramp up in April, May, and June gives us additional time to kind of highlight what those partnerships may look like and think about things like data sharing and financing.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got left behind a little bit. Commissioner Designee Ms. Ricci has known me long enough to know I need small words. Slow ramp up. This looks like 145% increase in the determinations, renewals, in three steps. And at your previously stated work time of about an hour per renewal, I think that's 9 or 10 worker years of additional work per month in three steps. 2 years to train an eligibility tech. How do we get this into the realm of possible?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. Well, first of all, we're leveraging that automation. And so there's something called ex parte renewals that I talk about in the next slide. And the ex parte renewals are new. They're not something that currently is in process right now. And it essentially uses information from the ARES system, connects it with information that's available in other state databases, like from the Department of Labor and the Alaska Permanent Fund Division. If it can match up a certain percentage of the data necessary to make a determination automatically, then that application will essentially automatically be redetermined. A technician will not have to touch it. A beneficiary will receive notice in the mail that this has been renewed and people can move forward. I think the big question for us And this is what, you know, kind of all states are facing, because this is relatively new, is what percentage of our redeterminations will match up the information necessary to make that auto redetermination. And the estimates are pretty wide. I think California is looking at 25%. Some states are starting lower at 15%. Other states are starting higher at 50%. Because of some of the information we have access to, right now we are estimating around 40% of the applications in ARES will run through that redetermination, that ex parte process. But again, that's partly why we'll get a sense in April when that first run occurs of kind of what the reality is behind those numbers. So we're trying to match that up again with some of our staffing needs. I would also note that when Commissioner Designee Hedberg was talking about the hour to process applications, that was specific to SNAP applications, which is one of the more complex applications. My understanding is that Medicaid redeterminations can actually be faster or more streamlined. So we do have some efficiencies there. But we are also looking at how we can leverage, again, our external partners or potentially contractors, although our preference is always to train and utilize our own staff. But essentially, in order to make determinations, federal requirements state that a merit employee or an actual employee of the state are the individuals that have to make a redetermination. So part of what we're looking at is recognizing the training time, the recruiting time, where we're at now versus where we need to be at in April, May, and June, and then later on in September. Can we leverage additional support in gathering all of the documentation and contacting different beneficiaries so that the eligibility technician has everything almost in a packet handed to them to streamline their effort and their work? Those are things that we're trying to...
We have a time limit, so we'll just stop with the answer there. That's... You have a follow-up on that question?
Mr. Chairman, I just... and it might take... maybe it's a good one for follow-up to the committee, but I guess if we have a system that might get us to 40%, step one is a 91% increase, and then they go up from there. So I could use some follow-up on how the department plans to make it happen.
Maybe if you... give us a brief highlight of Commissioner Designee, how in the loop you'll be on hitting those numeric targets, if it's going to be daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and this April target of 10,900 or 11,000. Are you going to know on May 1st or May 15th if that target's hit? Can you help me with that?
So to the chair, yes, we work daily together. And so as soon as we find out what those benchmarks are, we can follow up and let the committee know. I think to your point, this is all hands on deck. So gathering the documentation is incredibly difficult. So that's why we want to leverage our partners so we can maximize our eligibility technicians, maximize the automation. It is a large arc of effort, which is why we are all hands on deck in addressing the system issues with workforce and IT systems and getting temporary contracts to support this arc of effort for the backlogs, so we're in a better position in 4 weeks, 3 weeks, starting April 1st. But we can follow up and provide updates.
That would be preferred, and it'd be nice to have an update in May, first part of May, to see how April went. And then we'll talk about how you want to update the legislature as we go forward, as we're in the summer. I think we need to keep track of this somewhat, so if it starts going awry, we know about it before next March, type of thing. So we have any other questions on this slide? We've got 35 minutes. Okay, we'll go to the next slide.
For the record, Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. I would also add that there are very specific CMS reporting requirements that begin April 8th that I think articulate some of the same information that the committee would be interested in terms of how many redeterminations have been initiated, how many have gone through the ex parte process, what the success rate is. So there are specific federal reporting requirements that will be made public as well. So moving on to slide 13, I talked a little bit about the ex parte renewal in advance. Essentially, this is a way that we can streamline redeterminations. I've already spoken about the different databases that are being leveraged through this. Again, we're estimating about 40% of renewals in ARIES will be processed this way. It's important to note that there are, again, these two systems that Commissioner Designee Hedberg has talked about. One is the ARIES system, which is where what we call our MAGI Medicaid enrollees, where their enrollment is maintained, and that's the vast majority of our Medicaid enrollment population. Over 200,000 beneficiaries have their enrollment maintained in that program. The other group of Medicaid enrollees, and these are largely our aged, disabled, and long-term care individuals who are engaged in the long-term care programs, their eligibility is stored on that older system, that EIS system. And so we're not able to conduct ex parte renewals for individuals in that EIS system. It is a smaller number of beneficiaries, we believe around 30,000. However, we need to make sure that we're planning for manual redeterminations for those individuals. I would note on this slide, again, April 1st, we have to begin redeterminations. The first batch of redetermination notices that have gone through this ex parte process, the notices to beneficiaries will be mailed April 15th. So people will start to receive notice regarding their redetermination status as early as April 15th. Moving on to slide 14, I've spoken to most of the slide already, but manual processing will be required for redeterminations where insufficient data exists within the databases that they were able to access to complete that automatic ex parte renewal, or where information indicates that the enrollee is no longer eligible for, no longer meets Medicaid eligibility criteria. Additionally, manual processing will be required for those enrollees whose eligibility is maintained in the EIS system. So we are working on planning for that. And then I've talked about some of the government requests to help support that additional manual processing, and then looking to what some other states have done.
Right. Senator Wilson.
And thank you, Senator Keel. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the state initiated any contracts today to help out this process of redetermination?
To the chair, Senator Wilson, yes. So our contract to support the virtual contact center is one of those contracts that will help, again, with the backlog, but the redetermination. So when Alaskans want to know the status or have questions about redetermination, we will have our staff plus 75 eligibility associates that will be able to answer their call and answer their questions.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question also went to the contracting out, and I guess it's a two-part question. I thought I heard Ms. Ricci say that a state employee or someone with the state had to process the redeterminations, but this talks about contractual tax processing redeterminations. If I could just get clarification on that. And the other was for contracting out what otherwise would be state jobs, have we gone through the process that the public employee contracts require for that?
So I'll take through the chair, for the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, through the chair, Senator Keel. The temporary contract that we have with the virtual contact center, I did engage with the union to let them know what we were facing and the process that we were going through. So we are in conversations with them. We were not able to do a feasibility study because of the compressed timeline that we have. And so we're in active conversations with them right now. In terms of, and I forgot the second part of your question. Oh, state employees. When we look at the bulk of information, the bulk of work that has to happen, we look at how can we leverage our partners. So again, how can we leverage our tribal health organizations, federally qualified health centers, hospitals they have direct contact with these Alaskans. How can we leverage them to support with communication and gathering documentation so that it's more efficient for eligibility technicians to, as Deputy Ricci mentioned, to receive that application. Federal law requires that a state employee make that decision. That is not going to be contracted out. but how do we wrap our state employees around with the support from our partners and from some contracts to make sure that they have the resources needed in order to do their job as we get through the arc of effort with the backlog and this arc of effort with the redetermination process.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
For the record, Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. So moving on to slide 15, I'm just covering a little bit disenrollment. So initial disenrollments from the effects of the redetermination effort could occur beginning June 1st. Now, this can be, I feel like with all things healthcare, this can be a little complicated because the ending of the continuous unwindment, the continuous enrollment period, is March 31st. So it is possible that an individual could be disenrolled between April 1st and May 31st when they may be interacting with the Division of Public Assistance or other programs, and it becomes apparent when they're reviewing all of the programs an individual is eligible for that they're no longer eligible for Medicaid. But as a result of our initiating redeterminations specifically to kind of those different batches on a monthly basis, the first disenrollments would occur beginning June 1st, 2023. A question everyone is asking is how many recipients do we estimate will no longer be eligible or will be disenrolled as a result of this? That's a really hard answer, and I do not have a firm number. I can tell you that since 2020, we have 30,000 more Alaskans enrolled in the Medicaid program than we did 3 years ago. I don't anticipate that all of those will necessarily be ineligible, be determined ineligible, but we don't know at this point. If an individual is disenrolled, they do have fair hearing rights. Those are available. And most recipients who are disenrolled will be transitioned to the federally facilitated marketplace so that they can stay enrolled or stay covered and sign up for insurance through that option. That is generally automated for, again, talking about these two different systems. That process is automated for individuals whose enrollment is stored in the ARES system. For those small group of people whose enrollment is stored in the EIS system, that is not automated, and they will receive notices versus having their application be automatically transferred over. So again, we are working to make sure that we can support individuals who are disenrolled as they transition to other options. Our goal is to make sure everyone stays covered through the various health insurance options available to them. But we will need to work with some of our external partners with that support, particularly some of the groups that set up health insurance navigators as well as the Division of Insurance.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Getting in touch with beneficiaries, I know, can be tricky. Folks who need a hand are often chasing work and chasing housing arrangements and making it happen, but don't keep the most consistent mailing addresses. I understand the department is in process of a dedicated way for Medicaid beneficiaries to update their contact information, and I wonder, that sounds great. I wonder if you could tell us about that. I also understand that the federal government requires new and different ways of reaching out to people you don't have contact information. Can you tell us where you are with that?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, this is Emily Ricci for the record. So to answer your first question, which is how can individuals update their contact information right now, knowing the redetermination effort is upcoming? The Division of Public Assistance has established a separate option. When you call into the virtual contact center or the VCC, that option is staffed by an eligibility technician. The only activity that they can engage in is to take that information and update the individual's contact information in their system. And the goal of that is to make sure that that line and that option is available and does not get backed up. So they're not able to answer any other questions about applications. Their purpose is really to take that information and update it. So we have postcards that will be going out in the mail to Alaskans, reminding them to keep their contact information updated and call the VCC. We want to make sure that we can support the volume that will create. And so right now we're just looking at that before we send those postcards out. But we have a full public communications plan that we will be, we are starting to roll out, and you will see ramp up. In terms of requirements, there are certain requirements in that Consolidated Appropriations Act regarding how our systems need to ingest updated address information from the National Change of Address Database, as well as how individuals can be disenrolled and what steps the division must take before they can engage in that disenrollment, particularly if they have been unable to contact the member through the mail or if they get returned mail address. I will tell you, one of the areas we are working on in our mitigation plan with CMS is our ability to access the National Change of Address Database. Right now, that is not automated in ARES. That is underway. We anticipate that coming online later in the summer. So we're working with CMS on that mitigation plan. In terms of contacting beneficiaries, you are correct that they are required to contact them, not just through sending a letter if they don't get a response, but attempting to contact them in other means. Right now, the plan is to call them, and we are looking at other ways that we can kind of collect their additional information in terms of emails or potentially texting. But right now the plan is to engage in phone calls as well if we're unable to reach them through the mail.
If you could give us shorter answers, that'd be appreciated.
Thank you.
We'll go on to the next slide, please.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. This articulates some of the different, some but not all of the different federal requirements involved that were outlined in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2023. There are four major areas that we are working on with CMS mitigation plans. Those include adding, connecting with the National Change of Address Database, the ex parte renewals for individuals in that EIS system, the transferring disenrollments for individuals in the EIS system to the federally facilitated marketplace, and then developing that online submission. So we're in active conversations with CMS about what our mitigation plan is and articulating timelines and milestones. But I'm not going to spend time talking through this slide unless there are specific questions.
No questions on the slide? Okay. Go on to slide 17.
Moving on to slide 17, I think we've spoken a lot about this in the past, so I'm not going to spend a tremendous amount of time talking about it. Except to say that in order to remain compliant, which makes us eligible for enhanced federal FMAP as well as additional federal funding, we need to demonstrate to CMS that we have an approved mitigation plan, that we have set dates for reaching compliance, and that we are actively working towards that. CMS developed a form that states are completing right now. I think that was released 2 days ago, that I think can kind of that will be a very helpful tool in articulating what those compliance measures are.
So could you help me or remind me again when the department became notified that they'd have to re-enroll everybody and do their determination when that took place?
Chair Stedman, those requirements were finalized in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2023 that was released in the end of December. I don't remember if it was somewhere between the 20th and the 31st of December, I believe, but it was. In the end of December. There has been ongoing talk nationally about when the public health emergency would end, but there is no specific date regarding this until December.
So was there any lead time other than that?
Through the chair, yes, there was, which is, and there was some, I think there was some general awareness of what could be required by CMS or what they would be looking for, and that is why the division engaged in the programming necessary to get the ex parte renewals up and going in the ARES system. I believe that effort started in the fall, but I'm not certain of those dates.
Okay. Any questions on this slide? On to the next one, I guess, slide 18.
For the record, Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking through slide 18, except that, again, we're still working to identify how we can leverage some of our external stakeholders to reach Medicaid enrollees that we're not able to reach, as well as leverage the contact information that they've created. So we're actively working on things like financing, data sharing agreements, articulating which organizations can support us in which ways and how that would be helpful.
Okay, we have any questions on this one? Because she's going to go to the slide she's been looking for all morning.
Chair Stedman, moving on to slide 19, this is just an outline of our communication plan. First phase is really to get ready, make sure your contact information is updated. The second is renew or transition, what do you need to do? I anticipate the communication plan will change and flex over the next few months in reaction to identified questions and needs, but it's important and it is a requirement that we engage in broad-based communication with Alaskans. So this is part of those requirements.
Okay. Questions on this slide? Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Will that plan be public? Will we be able to see it and share it with our constituents?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. Yes, we've shared the plan already in some initial meetings we're planning to meet with specific stakeholder groups and share the outline of the plan as well as some of the materials and really get their guidance in areas that we may have missed, right? I mean, we know what we know within the department, but these organizations that are engaging directly with enrollees may have other ideas and be able to contribute to ensure that we can reach everyone that we need to.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Can we? Senator Wilson.
Yeah, I have a question, I guess, on an earlier topic in terms of workforce and employees. Do
just saying, do you have a particular slide you want us to
refer to comment? Okay. Just a general question on this all in terms of workforce for the SNAP and Medicaid eligibility technicians that are working so diligently and hard. Are we offering opportunities for overtime for these employees?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, yes, actually, we have eligibility technicians that are working 7 days a week. Overtime is optional, and eligibility technicians can sign up if they choose to do overtime, but we are approving it.
And just as a follow-up to that, Mr. Chair, is that going to anticipate another sort of increase in the operational budget for employees, for those FTEs?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, no, we're not anticipating that. We've been using... It's the balance within the operating budget, so we've been able to manage it so far.
Thank you.
And can we go back to slide 11, please? Don't worry. We won't start over here for the last 20 minutes. But, you know, we've got, I guess, some appropriations and stuff. But one of the things we're struggling with the department is trying to help you get ahead of the problems, and our role is, you know, fairly restricted on just the appropriation side. And we're certainly not afraid of tackling bigger, tougher problems. That's what we do here, right? So we'd rather have them early than late. But one of the challenges that we have is with Medicaid projections and dealing with information flow. So I think there's been a request and an issue to have more information flowing to Ledge Finance from the department. Can you give us an update on that if you guys have that all worked out so we can stay a little more current?
For the record, Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health. To the chair, we are in discussions with the Office of Management and Budget as well as Legislative Finance Division to provide those projections to the division. We met with them last week, and I will finalize up with the Office of Management and Budget to see when we can provide that information to the division.
Okay, so I know you guys are talking about it, and the request has been in, but has it been concluded so there will be a good flow of information in Legislative Finance?
To the chair, Senator Stedman, I'm hoping to get that information to Legislative Finance within the next couple weeks.
Okay. Because we want to keep up on that so we don't have surprises in the winter when we come back in for the budget time, along with, I think it would be a big, we'd be very interested in if you're attaining your targets, dealing with the issues at hand here, so we can see if you hit the 26,000 a month or whatever it is. And if you have problems, it's nice for us to know sooner than later, because we're actually here to try to help the department, not to hamstring you. You know, but we certainly can't have the appropriation conversation if we don't know there's a need. And we do recognize the size of the department, the complexity, and trying to keep the growth of the department reasonable, so it doesn't have runaway costs, but that doesn't mean we're going to sit back and watch the department implode on itself, because that doesn't work. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and encourage you to work with Ledge Finance and let us know, because we'll be asking them, I guess, how that system's going, so we don't have to put encouragement in your budget to ensure that there's a good information flow. We'd just as soon have it all voluntary. Do we have any other final questions, concerns? Okay, with that, I'd like to thank the department for coming forward. I know it's not fun to come to the Finance Committee and talk about problems, but I find it's been a lot better just to air the laundry out on the line, put the whole neighborhood look at it, and then we just fix it, rather than pretend it doesn't exist, because it's things happen in life and in our budgets that are out of our control. We just deal with them. So that's going to conclude the meeting today. The next meeting will be Tuesday, March 7th, 9 a.m., and we will be posting the agenda later today when we work through what it is. I think there might be some bill work and some other things next week. And then we're going to, for those watching at home, we're going to be gearing up the subcommittee process in the Senate. The House, the other body, looks like they're going to be concluding their subcommittee process, and then there may be a week delay after that. So we'll be gearing that up full speed on our side. And we'll be having subcommittee meetings and working with all the members to try to come up with a proposed operating budget that the committee writes. With that, we are adjourned at 10:47 a.m. We are adjourned.